ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाखाया चक्षुर्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कदम्बयं ददाति स्वापदन्तिकम् वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरो श्रीयुतपदकमलं श्रीगुरुं वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपां साग्रजातां सहगना रघुनाथान्वितं धं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजना सहितं कृष्ण चैतन्य देवं श्रीराधा कृष्णपदां सहकना ललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितंश्च हे कृष्णा करुणा सिन्धु दीनाबन्धु जगत्पथे गोपेशा गोपिका खंडा राधा खंडा नमोस्तुते तप्त कांचना गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानु सुधे देवी प्रणमामि हरि प्रिय वंश कल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुभ्य एव च पतितानां भावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासती गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरि 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 राम हरि राम 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 हरि हरि हरे कृष्ण हरि बोल Thank you for being here this evening, and thank you for allowing me to be with you. Special gratitude to Mother Mukya Devi for inviting me, and to all of the assembled devotees. When I travel to various parts of the world, it seems that when I come to Alachua, everybody I've ever seen is here. Just like all rivers flow to meet the sea, it seems like all devotees eventually end up in Alachua. You have such a wonderful, beautiful community here. By Srila Prabhupada's grace. Today is the disappearance day of Jayananda Prabhu. And I was by the will of destiny, I was always somewhere else from where he was, physically, on this earthly plane. but from the stories of devotees, by the letter and appreciation of Srila Prabhupada at the time of his disappearance, it's very clear the substance and the spirit that was the very foundation, the all-in-all of his life. Srimad Bhagavatam tells, Atha Pumbir Vijastrestas Varanashrama Vibhagasha Shvanushtatasya Dharmasya Samsidir Haditoshanam. That the perfection of all of our duties in this world, social duties, occupational duties, religious duties, is to give pleasure to Lord Hari, to Krishna. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his Shikshastakam, it was Sri Radha, the very origin and complete whole of all prema or devotion, speaking as Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Radha Bhava Duti Subalitam Nomi Krishna Swarupa. Mahaprabhu taught us, Na dhanam na janam na sundarim Kavitam vaja gadisha kamaye Mama janmani janmanishwari bhavatad bhakti rahoit kitvai. What should we aspire for? We were just discussing with some devotees the concept of simplicity. Srila Prabhupada quotes Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Prabhupada, that the first principle of a Vaishnava is simplicity. Unless we build the foundation of all of our spiritual sadhana, all of our spiritual activities of services, whatever positions and roles we may take, unless it's built on this foundation of simplicity, it will not really be fully connected to the grace of Krishna. And what is simplicity? Sometimes Prabhupada explains simplicity means to be without duplicity. And on a spiritual platform, duplicity is to have any interest outside of Krishna's interest. In other words, to have our own selfish agenda. What we speak, what we do. Simplicity means to be simple. That what pleases my guru, what pleases the Vaishnavas, what pleases Krishna, that is my aim. That is a simple heart. If we don't have our own egoistic, selfish agenda, there's no question of arrogance. There's no question of hypocrisy. Janasya moho yamaham mameti. When we think in terms of I and mine, that's like the groundwork by which all these other anartas develop. So Lord Chaitanya taught us a simple principle. What should be our aspiration? First, he tells us, Trinarapi Sunichena, Toror Ibasiishnana, Amanina Manadena Kirtaniya Sadahari. That our aspiration should not be to be seen as someone great. Because if we think ourselves to be great in anything, we cannot appreciate Krishna's greatness. something strange just came to my mind. Now, don't be offended by this. But in the West, when somebody is really, like, obnoxious, we say that they're full of it. No details beyond that. Really, we become full of ourselves. Oh, I am so good singer. I am such a great scholar. I am such a great chanter. I am such a great cook. I'm such a great leader. As long as we're thinking we're great in anything, we can't appreciate Krishna's greatness because we're full of ourselves. But when we're actually humble, we can appreciate Krishna. And that's what bhakti is about. Bhakti is not about what I can do. It's about how we're appreciating what Krishna does. With love. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says we should aspire to be more humble than a blade of grass. More forgiving and tolerant than a tree. I was recently telling of a story of a lady who our devotees in Bombay had just met. She was in a completely desperate situation. She was abused, rejected. Have you all heard this story? I told it at New Vrindavan. How many of you have heard it? How many have not heard it? So what should I do? Tell it? You sure? He said, please, what can I do? I'm bound by devotees. Anyways, I'm going to make it really short. At least that's my initial intention. So, just a couple months ago, it was Women's Day in India. I think it was international. It was especially prominent in India this year because there's several young girls and ladies have been raped, and there's been major demonstrations in Delhi for the government to do something about this. So we have our Bhaktivedanta Hospital. And the people who donated the land, the Dalmia Trust, is an educational institution. And in one of their auditoriums, they invited very elite people from Mumbai to come for this event. And some of our devotees who are in that area were invited to come. And they told me the story. In fact, they gave me a recorded transcript. So what I'm saying is just what I heard. So the lady who came as the keynote speaker, she told her life. She was born in total poverty. When she was a little girl, so much she wanted to go to school. Because nobody in her family had any education. But her father and mother told her that she had to herd buffaloes during school because the family had some buffaloes. So she would have her little stick. She was like 4 or 5 years old, and buffaloes are really big, water buffaloes. And she'd herd them, and it's a very dry area. She was from a village not too far from Pune. And the buffaloes would graze in the various shrubs. And then she'd bring them to a pond of water where they'd all go. Buffaloes like to go in water and stay for a long time. And then she'd run to school. And when she'd get to school, the teacher would beat her for being late. And then as soon as the class was done, she'd run to go get the buffaloes, and oftentimes the buffaloes had already traveled to somebody else's land. And then those people would beat her. And she talked about how those were the happiest days of her childhood. Because when she was 9 and a half years old, she was married to a man who was 35. And when she was 19 years old, she had 3 sons and was 9 months pregnant with another child. And somehow or other, this one person was exploiting the women of the village monetarily. And she reported him to a politician, and the politician stopped his activities. And he was so angry. He was kind of a powerful person. He went to this lady's, her name was Sindhutai, he went to her husband and said, "I've been having an affair with your wife, and the child in her womb is not yours, it's mine. And if you don't kill her, then I'm going to destroy you." So the husband kicked her in the womb repeatedly until she was unconscious. And he thought she was dead. Then he dragged her to a cow shed and threw her under the hooves of the cows, because it would seem that way that she was trampled by cows to death. But there was one cow, a mother cow, that chased all the other cows away and stood right over her body. Didn't move. And any other cows that went near her, that cow would chase them away. And even the in-laws came to make sure she was dead, and the cow chased them away. And she stood for hours and hours over this unconscious lady. And then she came conscious. And she had her baby under the cow. And there was a problem. There's this umbilical cord between her baby and her. So she didn't know what to do. She picked up a rock and sawed the umbilical cord to separate it. And she was so weak and beaten down, but the cow just stayed right on top of her, you know, standing, protecting, protecting, protecting. And she made a vow to the cow. That rhymes. Sorry, but I'm I did it. And she made a vow to the cow that as I was helpless and you saved me, someday I will give shelter to people who are helpless. She was in such a desperate condition, because when she was able to get up, being a 19, 20-year-old girl, she knew. She went to her own biological home, and they kicked her out, because it was a village superstition that once your daughter goes to somebody else's house, they cannot come back to yours to live. So she was sure she was going to get raped and abused. So where was she going to go? She went to the crematorium and resided there at night, where the people would burn the dead bodies. And she purposely would behave like she was totally crazy, so that everyone thought she was ghostly haunted. Then they wouldn't bother her. And that's where she had to raise her little infant child. There was some kind of a ritual where sometimes people would take wheat flour and make a circle around the funeral pyre before lighting it. She would take that wheat. That's what she was saying. She would take that wheat, add water, and she would cook chapatis on the burning corpses. Time went on, she felt so desperate and hopeless that suicide was again and again coming to her mind. And finally she decided, at midnight, she was going to place her body along with the infant under a train. So she went to the railway tracks. She heard the whistle of the train coming. She was approaching. And as she was about to lay in the railway track, she heard somebody screaming in agony. She went back to the railway platform and found an old man who was very helpless and was starving of thirst. So she went and got him water. And then she got him some, she went and begged and gave him food. And she was thinking at that time that it was a message of God. She specifically said it was a message of Krishna, that he has something better for me to do than commit suicide in this world. I can help others. But what was she going to do? So later that day, she was under the sun, and she was under a tree. And she was thinking, I've been so abused. How can I help anyone? Then she looked up and she saw something. She saw there was a branch on this tree that somebody had chopped repeatedly with an axe. And they just chopped it very sloppy. It was dun, dun. The branch was just hanging from a shred from the tree, all chopped up. And she noticed that that branch was giving her shade from the sun. So she considered, this is Krishna's message to her, that even if she is so much beaten down and axed by others, by destiny, still, she could live to help others. So she went back to the railway platform and found there's always these orphan or rejected children. And she became their mother. And she started a little orphanage at the crematorium. And she would go out, and then she was a nice singer, so she would sing and ask people for bakshish, donations, and that's how she would maintain these children. And eventually, after some time, people saw how she was helping so many helpless people. She was actually living according to the vow she made to that cow. It's interesting. No matter how desperate and situations of destiny may be in our life, if even a single person is kind to us and helps us, if we focus on that, that could give us the strength, the inspiration, and the power to transform our life and make it something wonderful. And a person may not even be human. So eventually people saw what she was doing, and they called her the mother of the orphans, and some people made an orphanage for her. She was giving all of them education, and years went by. She said that after many years, she was starting to receive so many awards. One was from the chief minister of Maharashtra. She got another award from the prime minister of India. And at that time, the family of her in-laws saw that she was worth something. So they invited her to their house. And she went. And there was a strange person who kind of walked in the door. He looked like a really strange, old, helpless person. By this time, this person was 80 years old. She didn't know who he was until he identified himself. He introduced himself as her husband, the one that kicked her and left her to die. And now he was homeless and hungry and in total desperation. And she said to him, "When you left me to die, you were dressed nice, and I lived in rags. But now I'm dressed nice, and you are in rags." She said, "When you rejected me, I was starving, and you were eating nicely. Now I'm eating nicely, and you are starving. And I'm very pleased to see this." Then she said, "I see you're totally helpless. I'm here to help you." She said, "But not as your wife. I'm done with that. Now I'm only a mother. I will be your mother. You could come and live in my orphanage. I forgive you for all you've done." He was so desperate, he moved in her orphanage. And she took care of him. In fact, she's still taking care of him as we're speaking today. And she introduces him to everybody who comes. "This is my eldest son. And he's been very naughty. But he deserves more love than anyone because he needs it." And when people who know the story, they say, "Why do you want to keep him?" You know, some of the other children in the orphanage, she said, "Because of him, I'm helping you. Don't you see? If he was a nice husband, I would have just been a traditional housewife." Because, she said, because she said to her husband, her son, whatever, you, her 80-year-old eldest son, she's 62 now, she said, "Because of you, I now have 1,550 children. And I have 235 sons-in-law. And I have 35 daughter-in-laws. And I have over 1,000 grandchildren. And all of them are well educated. And the three sons that were born of her, after she started the orphanages, they left their father to live with her. They have PhD now. One of them did their PhD thesis on their mother's life. And the daughter, who was born under the cow and used to, you know, eat the crematorium rotis. She's a doctor. And she runs one of her orphanages now. But she told the audience that the greatest thing she ever did in her life, she said she's gotten over 272 awards and she's been invited to speak in 14 countries. But the greatest fulfillment and the greatest thing she considers she's done in her life is to forgive her ex-husband and give him shelter. So this is a story of things that happen in this material world. But it does lead us to that universal spiritual principle when we connect it to Krishna. That there's a saying, if you get, in order to make a living, you get things. In order to make a life, you give. In bhakti, the simplicity of the heart is the joy of serving. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave us this verse. My Lord, I do not want wealth. I do not want the pleasures of the opposite sex. I do not want fame or power. I do not want to be a great poet or a great scholar. I don't even want liberation from suffering. My only aspiration, my only prayer, is that I may serve you unconditionally, birth after birth after birth after birth. The Bhagavatam describes this is the Param Dharma, the Supreme Dharma. Savai Pungshang Paro Dharmo Yato Bhakti Radhokshiji Ahoitaki Apratihata Yayatma Suprasediti. That the Supreme Dharma, the Supreme Occupation, the Supreme Religion is loving service to the Supreme Lord. But that service must be unmotivated by selfishness or egoism and uninterrupted by any circumstance that may come upon us. That is unconditional devotional service. When we really take that principle of unconditional loving service as the goal of our life and place it on the altar of our highest aspiration, and we interpret everything that happens in our life according to this principle, then we're truly on the path of bhakti. Rupa Goswami tells, true bhakti is not mixed with any desires for personal sense gratification or subtle sense gratification. Not even desire for mystical yogic powers. Not even desires for liberation. Simply for the pleasure of Krishna. This is what Srila Prabhupada, from the first day he came to America, even before he set his feet on American soils, while he was on the Jaladuta, he wrote his prayers. Prayers of unconditional love. Most people, 70 years old, just 37 or 38 days on an ocean cargo ship, not knowing anyone in the country you're going, not having any money, most of us would probably pray, Krishna, have somebody waiting for me. Give me a place to stay. Please understand, he had never stepped foot anywhere except outside of India in his life. But his prayer was, Krishna, give me the words to reach their hearts with your message to make them happy. Let me be your puppet. Make me dance as you want me to dance. Your insignificant beggar, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. That little prayer is the foundational basis of the ISKCON movement. That was his purpose. And it's that unconditional loving service, which is the ultimate purest state of the liberated soul in love. To give that, to receive that and give that, is the purpose of our society. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he came with this treasure house of Prema Bhakti, the Prema Nidhi. And Kaviraj Goswami tells that the Pancha Tattva, they plundered the storehouse of Prema, love of God, and they tasted the content. And then they distributed that constants profusely in all directions. Our sadhana, our satsang, association with one another, it gives us the means by which we can actually begin to taste the sweetness, the param drishtva nivartate, the higher experience of love for Krishna. But Srila Prabhupada, he taught us that as we're tasting it, we want to please Krishna, and what pleases him most is that we receive it with a humble and sincere and enthusiastic heart through hearing his glories, Hari Katha, Hari Kirtan, and by sharing that gift with others. I was speaking this morning with Kalakanta Prabhu and a few devotees, and telling about one time, this was in the early 80s, I was at a rainbow gathering. Do you know what a rainbow gathering is? It's a very colorful event. But about 10 to 15,000 hippies go to a counterculture or whatever you want to call them. But they go to live in a wilderness of a national forest once a year, where there's no electricity, there's no telephones, there's no running water, there's a lot of trees. Anyways, we were having kirtans and giving lectures and doing dramas and cooking. We couldn't cut down a living tree. We don't do that anyway. If we were just finding old dead trees and chopping them up and using it for wood, and we'd bring in big giant pots, and we were cooking for 3,000 people a day for dinner. And I used to make the halava. About 50 gallons of halava we would make for dinner every night. There was usually 6 preparations. And there would be this line of 3,000 people coming. They were hungry, though, because they're living out in the forest in tents and teepees. And everyone had all kinds of different bowls. Some had like upside down frisbees. Some had like some old, you know, flattened tin can ripped open. And some had like a plate, and some had, you know, leaves. But there was one interesting man who approached. He looked like he was about 70 years old. He was an American. He had gray, totally matted hair that went way below his waist. And big beard, gray, scraggly as anything. He looked exactly like a sadhu from the Kudumba Mela. In fact, he was totally naked. He didn't even have a copan. He was completely naked. And his body was all shriveled up due to old age. And we had a six-course feast. And his plate was a half of a empty coconut. It's the coconut shell cut in half. It's this big. Now, how to fit six preparations in that? So I was serving, and he came up to me. And I looked at him. One of those examples, you can't judge a book by looking at its cover. He looked like he was totally insane. And he said, "Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Sure." I didn't know if I should say that, but I said it. He said, "Are you connected with Swamiji?" I said, "Which Swamiji?" He said, "The one who used to live in the Lower East Side in the Bowery." He said, "The one who used to live in the Bowery." That's what he said. I said, "You knew Swamiji?" He said, "Oh, yes, he was my old friend." He said, "I was a student of Dr. Mishra. And Swamiji used to lead kirtans. And after he'd lead kirtans, while Dr. Mishra was giving lecture, Swamiji would sit in the back. And I would sometimes go over to him. And he'd ask me, 'Do you understand what he's saying?' And I would say, 'No.' And he'd say, 'Yes, it's nonsense.'" I'm just repeating. So he invited me. Swamiji was living somewhere in the Bowery. He said, I didn't even know where he lived. He said, he invited me to have prasad, or he invited me to have lunch at my house. So he had an apartment. And Srila Prabhupada, you know, the first thing they did is they went shopping. They went to a supermarket. And, you know, he was going to pay. And Prabhupada bought some vegetables and some grains, and they went to the cashier, and she went... She said, "That will be $8.49. This is what this old man's telling me. Meanwhile, there's like 1,000 people behind him in line. But this was very enthralling to me. She said, "That will be $8.49. And Srila Prabhupada, with great respect and compassion for this cashier, he said he was just so like her father, like her best friend. He looked at her and said, "I'll give you $3. This is Manhattan Island. She was shocked. She was in culture shock. She said, "Sir, it's $8.49. And he said, "It's not worth that much." "But sir, if you don't like it, then you don't have to buy it." He says, "No, I want it." He said, "You know, I could get this for $2.50 other places, but I'm giving you $3. She said, "In America, we don't bargain like this. There's a price tag on everything. It's $8.49. And Prabhupada just looked at her with such compassion that she reached in her purse. She took out like $5.50 from her own purse and put it in the cash register and said, "All right, you know, you take it." And she did it, but she did it with not like frustrated, but she was really happy that she did that for Prabhupada. And then Srila Prabhupada cooked for this person, and then they ate together. And then Prabhupada was telling him all about Krishna and all about, you know, the Bhagavad Gita. And then he told me, but he didn't know his name was Prabhupada. That was the only contact he's had him since. He said, "Swamiji taught me." He said, "He taught me something that I still do today." It's the one thing that Prabhupada taught him that he practices. To lie in his left side after eating. He said we laid next to each other on our left sides on the floor. And Swamiji took a nap and I took a nap and then we... So this is Srila Prabhupada. This is the basis. To give the beautiful, matchless gift of bhakti. And one of Srila Prabhupada's very earliest disciples was Jayananda Prabhu. Recently I was a Shamsundar Prabhu. And he told me that Jayananda Prabhu was one of the first devotees to join in San Francisco. And he was kind of older than most of the others. And he continued to work in order to support the center. Not only did he work for a good portion of the day earning money and giving 100% of it to Prabhupada, but he would clean, he would get the boga, he would fix anything that needed repairs or renovations, and he inspired everyone by his incredible enthusiasm to serve. He wanted nothing in return. He just wanted to please the devotees, because he knew that's how he could best please Prabhupada, is to please the devotees. And that was his life. Amani Namanadena, he offered all respect to others. He would go to these markets where some of the ruffians, you know, were just out to make a living somehow or other by hook or crook. And he would appreciate them as spirit souls. Srinivasacharya explains the six Goswamis were loved by both the gentle and the ruffians, dira dira. And when he would come, even if they didn't know anything about what is Krishna or what is Krishna consciousness, even if they were atheists, even if they were Christians or Jews or Muslims, whoever they may have been, when Jayananda came, they all understood, this man is the saint amongst us. He is a saint. Because of his power to actually see the good in everyone and inspire that, appreciate that. His natural quality is, if you love people, people love you. At least, sometimes. Not always like that. But if we're just looking for love, even if people love us, we probably won't recognize it. but in giving we receive. This morning, Kalakanta Prabhu told a beautiful story about Jayananda Prabhu. May I tell you?
Yes.
He's probably told it to all of you, but I'll tell it anyway, because I'm enthused. Somehow, Jayananda Prabhu was wearing, you know, he just had these really old, like, clothes. And so there was, you know, some event or something where devotees felt that he needed to, you know, have at least something that looked clean and respectable and not totally trashed out. So they told him he needed to get a pair of pants. But he didn't want to spend any money on himself. He was practically financing the whole temple, but he was giving all the money for the devotees. But they said, you have to get a better pair of pants. So they went to some kind of thrift surplus place where you get, you know, used pants that somebody else like sold for cheap. And he was with another devotee. And he told the other devotee, I can't spend money on myself. But I was told that I have to get pants. You think I should steal it? So the devotee said, yeah. So he looked around and he folded the pants up real small and kind of put it under something and walked out. And when he got to the door, the security man caught him and arrested him and brought him to the police. And then he was arrested. He was charged with shoplifting and brought before the judge. And the judge looked at him and said, do you plead guilty or not guilty? He said, Your Honor, I'm guilty. I stole the pants. But he said it with such humility. He said it with such humility that the judge kind of looked at him and said, Why did you steal the pants? And the security guard who caught him was standing next to him, you know, to testify, yes, he did steal these pants. So the judge asked, why? And he said, because, you know, I'm a devotee of Krishna, God, and we have a temple, and we hardly have any money, and we need so much money for helping others in society and for serving God. And there's so many people in our monastery or our ashram that are in so much need. And I needed pants, but I didn't want to spend money on myself. I wanted to use this money for everyone else. As he was saying that, the security guard, right in front of the judge, in the courtyard, the security guard who caught him started crying and said, Judge, he reached in his pocket, he said, I'll pay for the pants. Just dismiss all charges. The judge had tears in his eyes. That was how he could affect people's hearts. Whatever Srila Prabhupada wanted, that was his life, his soul, his everything. Someone just told me today that he took the Gayatri Mantra from Srila Prabhupada. And then Later on, Tomo Krishna Goswami, who was not Goswami at the time, got initiated, and he went up to get his Gayatri Mantra from Prabhupada. And Jayananda asked, could I go with you? Because I want to get it again, because I don't remember it. So, Tomo Krishna Goswami told a story. Prabhupada was having him repeat the Gayatri Mantra for a half hour. And he still didn't get it so right. And Prabhupada said, however you chant it, Krishna's going to be pleased. Just try your best. Because of his devotion, because of his sincerity, because he was a hoitaki apradihata. He had no personal motivations. He was who he was. And he loved to serve. He loved to please the Vaishnavas and to make Srila Prabhupada happy. And he had such determination. His determination was like a thunderbolt. But the execution of how he expressed it was like a soft rose. And he made the first Rathayatra chariots. And he would have a whole crew of people, who would just, it would be the highlight of their year to assist Jayananda Prabhu in making the chariot for Rathayatra. And when he was dying of cancer, he helped to make that chariot for the New York Rathayatra. And Srila Prabhupada was so pleased. And even when he was going through a prolonged suffering of cancer, never complained, never blamed, always grateful, always gracious, always eager to serve in whatever way he could serve. What he represented, Srila Prabhupada considered so important for us. That when he passed from the world, Srila Prabhupada wrote a letter to him. He wrote a letter to the immortal soul of Jayananda. Something like, he wrote, if you had any desires or something, then you will go to the heavenly planets for 10,000 years and enjoy. But because you have no material desires, you have gone back to home, back to Godhead, to Goloka Vrindavan. Srila Prabhupada put in writing, and it was distributed to our whole movement, his letter to Jayananda Prabhu, that you have gone back to Krishna. And Prabhupada expressed his immense gratitude to Jayananda Prabhu and his prayers and blessings. And then Srila Prabhupada did something which I believe is unprecedented in our society. He said every year, Jayananda Prabhu's disappearance day should be celebrated on our Vaishnava calendar as a holy day to commemorate him. And wherever there's Rathayatras anywhere in the world for all time in ISKCON, Jayananda Prabhu's photograph should be on the chariot. Simplicity. He was confronted with as many complexities of this world as anyone else. The complexities of so many people's egos in this world, and the complexities of politics, and the complexities of so many disturbances caused by the general population, caused by envious people, caused by other devotees, caused by the weather, caused by earthquakes or hurricanes, or caused by just destiny itself. Padam padam yadvi padam natesham. It's danger at every step. But what was the simplicity that Srila Prabhupada wanted us to understand in him? That whatever happened, he just wanted to serve. He just wanted to please Prabhupada, Krishna, and the Vaishnavas. That is Krishna consciousness. Chaitanya Das, the father of Srinivas Acharya, he was telling his little boy Srinivas about how he would meet Rupan Sanatan Goswami when they were the prime ministers of Bengal under the Nawab Husain Shah. He said once he went to Ramakeli and he saw Dabir Khas and Sakar Malik. He said their beauty were like Cupid, Kandarpa. They had such enchanting physical bodily features. He said their wealth was like Indra. They were like billionaires. They had palaces, wonderful clothes, massive properties, huge treasuries. Their scholarship was like Brihaspati. They knew Persian, they knew Sanskrit, they knew Bengali, they knew all these different languages, Brijavas, Hindi, and they were scholars of the scriptures who mastered, you know, all the great verses of the essence of the scriptures. And they could present them eloquently. And they had such fame, popularity, political power, they had everything. He said, but what was most astounding about them is even while having everything everyone wants, they were completely humble. From their heart of hearts, not just as a show, they honored and respected everyone. They would be sitting on the dais with all these great pundits, and if anybody came, whoever they were, they would get off the dais and sincerely welcome them, greet them, arrange prasad for them, arrange facility for them to stay. This is the most attractive feature. When a person has opulences in the world, the tendency is almost always to become proud and arrogant. The more you have, the more you have the inclination to be envious if somebody has anything more than you. And arrogant if someone has less. But to have those gifts and genuinely be humble, genuinely offer respect, and genuinely wish to serve, that is bhakti. Whether we have little or lot. Jayananda Prabhu, in many ways, he had unbelievable skills. In other ways, he didn't. But what Srila Prabhupada recognized in him is his unmotivated, unconditional desire to serve and to please. That is Srimad Bhagavatam. tomorrow is Narasingha Chaturdasi. And when we read the Leela of Sri Narasimhadev and Srimad Bhagavatam, there are many chapters, and Narasimhadev only comes at the end. It's really the story of little Prahlad. The glorification, Narada Muni speaking to Yudhisthira Maharaj, and Narada Muni's narrating this incredible story of Prahlad Maharaj. His unconditional desire to serve. And how the Lord was always there to protect him. And I'm going to end by telling one story. I'm going to change the topic a little. But it's not... I'm changing it a little, but not a lot. Do we have time for one story?
Yes.
Okay. I may have told it before, but I'll tell it again. Do you remember a few years ago when terrorists invaded the Taj Mahal Hotel in India? And for 3 days, the anti-terrorist squads of the Bombay police were fighting against these terrorists. They were killing people. Well, one of our devotees is in the anti-terrorist squad of the, because we have a big congregation with all kinds of people. It's in Bombay. I didn't even know that he was like that, but one day he came to the temple just like the day after and told me the story. They said when those persons were, you know, they had rooms stocked with ammunition. And they were really highly trained. And it was very difficult. Dozens and dozens of military could not touch them. Because they always stayed in a higher position. And they would just throw down all these hand grenades. And the hand grenades, the metal would start stabbing people. And there would be so much smoke that nobody could see them. But they knew where everybody was, and then have their machine guns like and shoot. And he said, we never could see them, so we never knew where to shoot back. They would just shoot, throw hand grenades, so much smoke, shoot at us, so we didn't know where to shoot back. So he said, at one point, he was there with two of his comrades, this one devotee. And they were just throwing these hand grenades down, and there was total smoke, and nobody could see anything. And they started shooting their machine guns down. And the police didn't know where to shoot. They were just, and it was like, and couldn't see anything. And when the smoke cleared, oh, no, he was in such a helpless state. I almost forgot the whole purpose of the story. He was in such a totally helpless state. But he had a photo of Narasimhadev on his cellular phone. And he had the recording of the Narasimha Stotram that we sing after every arti. Namaste Narasimhaya Tavakara Kamalavarenakam. So he turned it on the highest possible volume. And he had it in his pocket. And he was just standing there because he didn't know what to do. There was just bullets showing, and he didn't know where he was because they were kind of moving around, and he had no idea where he was, but it was just smoke, 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 and smoke. And they were shooting, and he was, as he was singing, is on the top of his lungs, he was singing along with the tape of the Narasimha prayers of the devotees. And the shooting stopped. And the smoke cleared, and he looked on one side of him, and one of his fellow police was completely covered with bullets and dead. And on the other side of him was another policeman covered with bullets and dead. And he was wondering, how is it that not a single bullet touched me? And then the smoke cleared more, and he saw right in front of him was a pillar. And the pillar was filled with bullets. And his realization was this, that to protect Prahlad, Nrsimhadev came out from a pillar. And to protect me, Nrsimhadev became a pillar. Anyways, he has very good faith now. Yes?
When I first read that, I was trained by Jayananda, so I'm say something about Jayananda.
Do we have time? Yeah? They said yes? Okay.
Is it okay?
When I first joined the movement in April of 1971, the devotees in the San Francisco Yatra, which was located in the Mission District, they came up to the hippie commune where I was at, called Wheeler's Ranch, and that's when I joined. You know Janakanath? He was the devotee that I went up to and I said, can you take me back to the temple? I didn't realize that he had lived on the commune and he had really long hair. And he had a shaved head. And he probably thought that I recognized him when I went over to ask him to take me back to the temple. But I didn't have the faintest idea of who he was because he looked totally different. Anyway, when I got to the temple, the first engagement I had was building the Rath Yatra carts. And we had just gotten this temple, and I don't think Prabhupada had ever seen the temple before. It was a large temple that used to be a mortuary. And so we had a space in Haight-Ashbury where we built the carts. And somehow or other, Jayananda took me under his wing. I don't know why he was so kind to me. I was like really, really, really spaced out. I mean, I had taken so many acid trips that I doubt whether I... If you think I'm spaced out now, you should have seen me. Maharaj and I, we knew each other actually before we joined the movement. We used to jam together. He would play harmonica and I would play piano. But that's a different story altogether. This is a Jayananda story. I'll tell that sometime. So anyway, Jayananda really took me under his wing. I mean, I'm not just saying that, you know, for false prestige, although I do have a lot of false prestige. And I really couldn't understand why he was so kind to me. He used to cook sweet rice in the parking lot where we were building the Rath Yatra cart on a Sterno stove, and it was famous sweet rice. Sometimes it had a little grit in it. Sometimes possibly some axle grease as well, but it was actually very, very transcendental. So he used to cook that all the time. The devotees used to eat it. And there was a garage adjoining the temple, and there was a shower in there, and somehow or other, myself and Jayananda, and maybe sometimes some others, but I just remember myself and Jayananda. I don't remember whether there are any others. We slept in the garage separately from the temple because we were the Rath Yatra crew, and we showered in there. And we were in a seedy neighborhood. There were a lot of drunks, winos, drug addicts in this area. It was a rundown area. There was a flea bag motel or hotel around the corner, and believe it or not, a Buddhist temple about two blocks away. And if Jayananda needed some particular service like moving a refrigerator or any type of heavy-duty service, he would go out into the street and recruit people who were passing by in the neighborhood, like drunks, winos, and drug addicts. And the way he just handled them was like totally amazing. It was like, before you know it, they were like just totally engaged in devotional service for that particular time. And I think the secret of the whole thing was that Jayananda did not have false prestige. So everyone could recognize that this man is not looking at me and judging me on a level that other people judge me. He didn't do that. He considered himself to be either the most ordinary person in the world or below everyone else. And the way that he knew that is that everyone would just be happy to do service for him. Another quality is that he could always find prasadam to give devotees. Like I remember once we were in the San Francisco temple and we were washing pots late at night after a feast. It must have been about 12 o'clock at night. And Jayananda said, "Let's have some prasadam." And he brought out the whole maha offering from the last offering. So we had some prasadam. Srila Prabhupada would always say, "Where is my Jayananda?" I remember in New York, I was also there for the first New York Rath Yatra. And Srila Prabhupada walked in the building with many of the ISKCON dignitaries. There was Tamal Krishna, Ridhananda Goswami, Brahmananda, and he was surrounded. And the first thing he asked when he got in the lobby is, "Where is my Jayananda?" And one of the small things I remember about... Can I just finish? Okay. Anyway, one of the things I just like to say is that when we had the Tulsi Puja, he would always, at the end of the Tulsi Puja, he would go, "Tulsi Devi, Haribol, Haribol," and he'd do a little jig around Tulsi Devi. I always remember that. So I felt very fortunate because he actually asked me to ride on the Rath Yatra cart with him to work the winches. So I was only a bhakta for 3 months, and I saw Prabhupada for the first time when he came for the Rath Yatra in July, and I got to ride on the Rath Yatra cart on Prabhupada's cart with Jayananda and work the winches. So I have a lot of memories, but I guess Mukhya is not doesn't really want me to tell him, so I'll hand the microphone back to you.
Hari Hari. Should we end now? Where is...
There's 15 minutes left, maybe 10 minutes, so perhaps you can ask a few questions. It's so rare that we get to hear you, so it's painful if I miss a minute. Maybe somebody would have a question for you.
Does anyone have any question? Prabhu, did you? Yes.
Adige told me that at the end he wanted to film things on 22nd Avenue, and then also there's something for...
That's something separate.
Go right. Do you want to do it between now and Artik or after Artik?
I don't, but not now. Haribol.
There was a question over there. Someone had, one of the ladies had a question. Did you have a question?
Maharaj, I would like to know, sometimes the mind contaminates any attempt that we have to serve Krishna, and our service to Krishna is always mixed with the desire to please Krishna, in my case at least, you know, and the desire to get recognition for the stupid things. So what do you do when the mind comes with ideas that they are directed to you be noticed instead of Krishna being noticed? What to do with that? Because that's my problem.
You are speaking on behalf of all living beings in Brahma's creation. Just that you recognize that and you want to take shelter of Krishna. To go beyond that is the symptom of your sincerity. Daivi yeshu gunamayi mama maya duratyaya mamai vamye papadyante mayame tatarantite. Krishna tells that this divine energy consisting of the three modes, this Maya Shakti, is very difficult to overcome. And Krishna tells in Gita, Bhumir Apo Nalo Vayu, that there are eight material elements. And the foundational basis of all material existence is the Ahankar, the false ego. So this is the subtlest and the most difficult to ultimately overcome. This desire to lord it over, this desire to be recognized. When it infects the mind becomes our enemy. Bandur atmatmanastasya. Krishna says that the mind could be the best of friend or the worst of enemies. So in Krishna consciousness we understand that the power of the ego and the power of the mind that is infected by the ego is beyond our power. But Krishna does say that if we take shelter of him, he will carry us beyond these obstacles. The ascending process of other schools of yoga or spirituality is by our own powers to overcome the mind. Krishna tells in Gita, Tani Saravani Samyamya Yukta Asita Matvara Vasehi Asyandriyani Tasya Pragya Pratishtita. That steady intelligence is when we restrain our senses. That means with the powers that we have, we make choices and execute those choices to actually not follow the dictations of the uncontrolled mind senses affected by the ego. But ultimately, those powers are beyond our own. Then we have to fix our consciousness on Krishna. We have to humbly take shelter of Krishna. To control our gross senses is extremely difficult. But the problem is, even if we could do that, we usually become proud of it. We become arrogant of it. And more or less, we spoil everything. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita tells about Vasudeva. He had leprosy. very advanced, acute state of leprosy. His whole body was decomposed to the extent that there were living worms eating his flesh. But he was so humble. He was thinking that the worm is living in my body and I'm living in my body. If a worm would fall out, he would pick it up and put it back. And nobody was watching. It's not like he had some camera and he was going posted on YouTube to show the world how merciful he was. He was totally rejected by society. He was living alone, and but this is how he actually felt. He had such honor and respect for the worms. But when he went to see Lord Chaitanya at the Kurma Brahman's house near Kurma Kshetra, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had already left hours before. And he was feeling the opportunity of my life I missed. But Lord Chaitanya understood his heart and came back and came to embrace him. And Vasudev, he tried to run away. But it describes that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had very long arms that extended below his knees. So when he wanted to reach to embrace you, there was no escape. And he embraced him. Vasudev said that my body is so abominable. It's so contaminated with pus and with blood and with infection of leprosy. It's contagious. And the smell of my body is so abominable that nobody will come even near me. But you have embraced me. Therefore, I can understand that you are the Supreme Personality of God. Nobody else could be so non-judgmental and kind, merciful. But when the Lord embraced him, all his leprosy went away. And at that time, Vasudev was very worried, and he was thinking in his mind, now when people see me, I have a beautiful, youthful, healthy body that's glowing because of Lord Chaitanya's embrace. And everybody knows that I was a leper. When they see me, they're going to think I must be some sort of very advanced devotee. Lord Chaitanya personally, God bestowed such mercy on me. But receiving such mercy, I will become proud. I will think myself better than other people who don't get such mercy. And as soon as pride enters the heart of a devotee, in Krishna's eyes, our devotional service is spoiled. So he was actually fearful of becoming proud, desiring this recognition. And Lord Chaitanya could read his mind. And Lord Chaitanya said, do not be afraid. Always chant the names of Krishna. And in a spirit of compassion, share the message of Krishna with others. If we take shelter of Krishna with that motivation to overcome our ego, by chanting, by hearing, by serving, then Krishna will see our intention. He'll see the sincerity of our intention and carry what we lack, preserve what we have. By Krishna's grace, we can overcome the most subtle and most powerful of all the obstacles, our own false ego. And when a person like you is crying tears, feeling humbled by the power of the ego, and actually cries out Krishna's names, and cries and begs for service in that spirit, Krishna help me, Krishna will surely help you. that answer your question? And that's what we're all here for, to help one another. We're all meant to be instruments of Krishna, to help each other, to remind each other, to facilitate each other, to forgive each other, to encourage each other toward that state of pure, unalloyed devotional service. And that's why we come for Srimad Bhagavatam class, for Hari Katha, for Hari Kirtan. That's our reason for coming together. To share Srila Prabhupada's grace and help each other to really humble ourselves to take shelter of Krishna. Hari Bol. Thank you very much. In fact, Srila Thakur Bhaktivinoda, he taught us that devotees pray to Lord Narasingadev to remove the anartas from our hearts, to save us from those anartas that are within us. And by doing so, to clear the way for pure devotional service. So tomorrow is Lord Narasingha's appearance. So everyone, please get nice rest. Should we have a few minutes of kirtan?
No.
The doors are about to open, so we will have kirtan. Is there a special type of kirtan for this darshan?